The Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Hey, hello. I'm like in your brain, or in via your ears. This is just a note to say that the podcast you're about to listen to is brought to you by the dudes at Motorola. Okay, enjoy, dude.
This is Time from the Microsoft Show, and I have an important message for people using Windows computers. It was recently discovered that Sony BMG copy-protected CDs install copy protection software as a rootkit, a set of tools that can allow processes and files to be hidden. On November 2nd, Sony released a 3.4 megabyte patch that will stop the files from being hidden and install Service Pack 2, an update for all the DRM components. Please note, if you install the patch and use Sony's player, the player contacts Sony each time it runs and sends an ID associated with the CD the user is playing, and it cannot be configured. If you played a Sony BMG copy-protected CD on your home or work computer, it is important to install the patch to remove the cloaking. There is a post and a podcast at microsoft.thepodcastnetwork.com with more information. And now, on with the show.
Hi, Cameron. How are you going?
Good, mate. Have you still got time?
Of course I've got time.
Your deadline was met successfully?
Yes, my deadline on whether we're ever going to find a cure for baldness was met successfully. No.
Do you have a personal interest in this subject?
Well, no. I mean, if you go to my blog, I actually put something on there about how hair grows, and I said if you look to the left, you'll see my rather dizzy photograph, which does prove that I have a full head of hair, and no, it's not a wig, so.
You're not doing the Bert Newton?
I'm not doing the Bert, I'm not doing the Loisy, but I was talking to the guy that cuts my hair yesterday about this sort of stuff, and he said that, you know, he cuts the hair of people that are, you know, ex-footy players and in showbiz, and once they start losing it, they tend to go for the hair transplants, but exactly what tends to happen is that you get your transplanted hair, but then the untransplanted hair, or the hair that you had, starts to fall out anyway, so you've got to keep going back and back. So it's a pretty pricey kind of thing, and as he says, you know, all these treatments are just putting off the inevitable, which is, you know, you're going to eventually lose your hair if you're going to lose your hair.
Would you go for their hair replacement if yours started to fall out, mate, or would you just go the Jean-Luc Picard?
That's a good question. I think I go to Jean-Luc Picard, but again, if you do go and look at my picture, you'll note that I've got a rather fine head for radio. So, I don't know. I think I've got an interest in at least keeping some sort of hair up there. It's kind of, you know, balanced the melon a bit.
You're a young bloke, Josh. How old are you?
I'm 32.
Yeah, just 32, mate.
Hang on, I think I'm 32. Yes, I'm 32. I was born in 1973, so, yes, and it was my birthday a few months ago, so definitely 32, and I've been in this journalism game for 10 years, so.
All right. Well, Josh, let's give you a formal introduction for people who have been listening for the last couple of minutes and they don't know who the fuck I'm talking to. Josh Glidden, journalist at the Bulletin magazine, once a very respected magazine in Australia, and then the Packers bought it, right?
It's a good question. I don't know how long ago it was bought by the Packers, but last year was our 125th anniversary, so we're the oldest magazine in Australia, and I mean, that doesn't really count for much these days, because I think that age doesn't necessarily mean respectability or venerability, but yeah, I'd say that we're pretty respected, and we're the only domestic news magazine, but I find when I go out, I have to say Bulletin with Newsweek, which is our official title, and when people hear the Newsweek part of it, if they're not familiar with the Bulletin, they at least know where we're coming from, and we do take stuff from Newsweek in the States for our international coverage.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. And well, the Bulletin's a good magazine, I believe. I obviously don't read it unless I'm in it, which is my general...
Well, you have been in it.
Yeah, I know. And well, that's what I was getting to. You know, that's... Because you gave TPN our first press coverage ever. Ever!
Yes, well, I was referencing the fact this afternoon that I was, you and I were going to be chatting, and I thought I was pretty early on, but it's kind of an interesting experience for a journalist to be on the receiving end of the the interviewer, you know. So I don't know whether this is the first step to becoming a personality rather than a journalist.
I was actually going to say this isn't so much an interview. I mean, when I have Ray Kurzweil on, that's an interview. When I have Noam Chomsky on, that's an interview. This is a chat.
It's a chat. Well, that's good. I prefer the chat. I prefer discourse rather than diatribe, so...
Well, you know, normally if I was going to discuss intelligent design, I'd have somebody who was, I guess, an expert on intelligent design and have a discussion with them, but you're a journalist who's recently covered intelligent design, and so I think, you know, we should have a chat about what you discovered in your recent research and the article that led to it, because it's something that's getting a lot of dialogue these days. And, you know, as I've said on my blog, scares the hell out of me, the number of people that seem to think it's a good idea. And the number of people that try to rationalise it scares the hell out of me. What the hell is happening to people out there? I swear they're putting drugs in the water. So anyway, let's what did you learn when you were researching the whole intelligent? Oh, before we go on, we should say that you write it's a science and technology column for the Bulletin, right?
Yeah, I'm the science and health. My official title is the science and health editor, but I also cover tech. And if I can get away with it, and they let me, I'll also drive cars and write about it. But my boss is less and less keen about me driving cars, and more keen about me writing about science and health and tech. So that's where I came to the whole intelligent design thing. And you know, we've been seeing with the Dover School Board in the States and the ongoing court case there about you know, whether intelligent design should be taught in schools there, and the U.S. situation is a little bit different to Australia because curriculum's set at local level rather than, you know, here in Australia it's set at state level. So that's why you hear us talk about the Dover School Board rather than, say, the Pennsylvania School Board. This doesn't work that way over there. So it's a bit different. And they've also got the other situation where the Constitution actually mandates this separation of church and state business. And so that's one of the schools of thought about this intelligent design thing. And we probably should tell people what intelligent design is if they're not quite sure. But one of the reasons people say that intelligent design is getting such a Guernsey in the States is it's a way for people who believe in creation or literal creation to kind of, you know, tweak it and modify their theory a little bit, present it as science, sneak it past the Constitution, and get it into schools. And so really, when you hear about this Dover School Board trial in the States, that's what it's about. So it's a constitutional issue, and both of the parties there have said they'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. So it's going to be really interesting to watch that one.
And, you know, the thing that concerns me about it is when otherwise seemingly intelligent people start talking about it like it is legitimate. Like, I've been having this debate with somebody on my blog over the course of the last few days. This person was saying on my blog last night that intelligent design didn't refute evolution. It took the theory of evolution and built upon it, added to it, complemented it, and therefore was equally legitimate. And I was like, wait. What a crock of shit. I mean, evolution is based on, you know, scientific method and intelligent design. Now, I'm not saying intelligent design is a crock of shit. I believe that people have, you know, should have the right to believe whatever the hell they want to believe. But let's not confuse it as being anywhere close to science.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think that it's really dangerous to start going around poo-pooing other people's beliefs. But you shouldn't really confuse intelligent design with science. And people say to me, well, why not? You know, there's people put up plausible standing scientific arguments that, you know, talk about molecular biology and genetics. And some intelligent designers, some intelligent people who believe in intelligent design say, you know, they believe in what's called microevolution. So you see the bacteria evolving to defeat antibiotics, but they don't believe in macroevolution. So it's kind of all over the place, and that people say, so, you know, why isn't this intelligent design thing scientific? And you say, well, what it comes down to is that intelligent design says that things are so complex it couldn't have arisen through spontaneous evolution over billions and billions of years. Therefore, there must be a designer. It's a very short step to go from the designer. You say, well, who the hell is the designer? To God. And there's no way in science to actually phrase a question that can test whether or not there's a God. It's not a scientific question. And so that's why it's not science. You can't prove or disprove God. And you know, if you could, it's like that old Hitchhiker's Guide thing, you know, I refuse to prove I exist as God gives proof to those faith, etc. And then the man says, well, what about the Babel fish? And God goes, well, I didn't think of that, and disappears in a puff of logic. So, you know, it's one of those things. It's like I spoke to Mike Archer, who's the Dean of Science at the University of New South Wales, and Professor Archer says it's really dangerous to start thinking that the Bible is God's lab notebook, because once you start doing that, then you all of a sudden find that there's scientific, there's, you know, a really strong disproof for something that people say is in God's lab book, then it actually starts to weaken the whole theology, and, you know, you don't really want to start weakening theology. So, yeah, I mean, intelligence, it's not science. It's a very particular kind of belief system that tends to be propagated by, you know, the Pentecostal type people, because you see the Catholics and the Anglicans come out and say, oh, you know, come on, people, let's get real here. It's certainly not science. So it's one of those sort of more clap your hands fundamentalist Pentecostal beliefs than it is what we would call the mainstream and shrinking mainstream churches.
Yeah, but, you know, increasingly there seems to be a range of people who are hearing about intelligent design and thinking, well, you know, on the surface of it, that it sounds sensible, and maybe it should be given equal time in schools. I mean, I've had this argument with my wife many times, and she's not a clap-your-hands fundamentalist, although she was brought up by clap-your-hands fundamentalists.
Well, so was I.
Well, there you go. But, you know, you're not that way now. You were cured, obviously, maybe.
Well, no, I'm certainly not a church-going clap your hands person. And I think that one of the difficulties is, say, you know, people who are opposed to evolution say that, you know, it encourages a culture of relativism because you don't have this absolute that's imposed by, you know, specialness, by special creation. So, you know, if man's been specially created by God, you get all of the morals and ethics that come from that. Whereas if we just evolve from an amoeba somewhere, then everything is relative. But when you start actually saying, oh, you know, we should teach intelligent design alongside scientific evolution in school, then that becomes relative as well, because you go, well, what else do we teach? You know, do we teach the flying spaghetti monster, or, you know, do we teach the Dreamtime myths in science, or do we teach the, you know, the Raelian aliens planted us here theory in science? Yeah, I think that we have science and we have scientific method for a reason, and we can put everything else into philosophy or religious studies classes, and that's where they should be.
A mythology class. I have no problem with them teaching any of that sort of stuff as part of a mythology class. But And the thing that concerns me is the human race spent thousands of years painfully dragging ourselves out of the realms of mythology into the realm of scientific method. And then we've, you know, increasingly over the course of the last 500 years particularly, we have weakened the hold that religions and mythology had over the way that we view the universe and the way that we view ourselves. And all the benefits are there to demonstrate that the scientific method, you know, has a lot going for it. Every time we start to slip a little bit backwards towards the Dark Ages I classify the whole God politics thing too, that seems to be rearing its head at the moment. It scares the hell out of me. We're slipping backwards. And we fought long and hard, and lots of people died to get us here, you know. Thousands of years of struggle.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of struggle, and I think that one of the reasons that these types of belief systems are growing is because people really want absolutes. Like, they want reassurance and they want absolutes. And, you know, I don't think anybody would argue that we live in interesting times, and when we live in interesting times, a lot of people do want the reassurance and the absolute sort of reassurance of knowing that, you know, we were created, we're special, God did this, God did that, etc., etc. And I think that's why these belief systems take hold. And I also think that within a lot of the churches, because you got to remember, this is very particularly a Christian belief system, a lot of the churches, people aren't really encouraged or pushed to think these things through. Like, I did speak to one of the pastors of one of the major Pentecostal churches, and he said, well, you know, we address origins probably once a year, and you know, we've got lots and lots of people with lots of university degrees, and everybody here is very intelligent. But he said, you know, we're not here to be a university and to argue about things. We're here to actually help people with their lives. And that's kind of where I start getting really, really cynical about that type of mainline church. And one of the things I did say in my story, which I subsequently excised, was that I thought maybe it was time for another reformation of the church, but I just don't think that'll ever happen. And you've got to remember that back, you know, back in Galileo's time, one of the arguments that was thrown at him, and his, you know, he was building on Copernicus's idea of heliocentrism, was that if the universe didn't revolve around the Earth, then it took away man's special place in creation and everything became relative. I mean, this is an argument that's hundreds and hundreds of years old, and you know, lo and behold, we know that that the universe doesn't revolve around the Earth, but it hasn't changed anything. So I think that, you know, churches really do need to, in my opinion, be more rigorous and encourage their parishioners to be more rigorous in their thinking and to understand that, you know, if we arose from the primordial, it doesn't undercut our, you know, whatever special relationship you want to have with whoever you think your creator is.
Yeah, it doesn't take away from people, you know, having their own belief system and their own religion and the privacy of their own home and, you know, worshipping whatever entity they want to worship. The dangerous part of it is, you know, when they start to follow this line of argument that says it's legitimate. I also hear... Actually, here's a question for you. Do you know where the whole intelligent design terminology came from? It seems to have cropped up, you know, obviously coming out of some of these issues in the US in the last couple of years. Do you know who cooked it up?
It was a fellow, a lawyer and a theologian called Philip Johnson. I think I have to consult my notes and double-check that. But anyway... He wrote a couple of books back in the mid-90s sort of questioning Darwinism, and one of the terms he came up with is intelligent design. But the root idea of intelligent design is certainly nothing new. It's a fellow in the 19th century, it's 200 years ago, it would have been the 18th century, William Paley came up with this idea of... And he didn't call it intelligent design, but he said that if you're walking along a beach and you found a pocket watch on the beach, then the complexity of the pocket watch is such that it would be logical to infer that there was a designer and that pocket watch didn't just spontaneously appear there on the beach. And that's one of the core arguments of this latter-day intelligent design, is that there are some structures in the body that are so complex that they couldn't have just spontaneously arisen, that there must have been a designer who put them together and then set them in motion. So I don't know if that answers your question, but there are sort of two antecedents for these ideas. I mean, the term intelligent design was coined, you know, 10 years ago, but the raw ideas are close to 200 years old, and they haven't really changed that much in that time, except for the fact that you've got organizations like the Discovery Institute in the US that have a couple of scientists on board who don't publish peer-reviewed papers, writing books and going directly to the public with these pseudo-scientific arguments.
Another thing that I hear from my Christian fundamentalist friends whenever we get into this discussion is they say, well, you know, the Big Bang theory is just a theory. There's no evidence to support it. And I'm pretty sure that's not true.
There's good evidence for it, but I think that what they miss is that they think that science and its pronouncements are gospel, and that, you know, that it's gospel in the same way that they think that their belief system is gospel. They view them as they view science as a rival belief system rather than a system that's actually self-correcting over time and whose very nature is to question its own foundations. And when better explanations come along, slot those explanations in to the foundations and remove the shonky old arguments. I think that's where people really misunderstand what science is and what science is about. They think, oh, it's just another belief system Baha'ism or Buddhism or Christianity. It's another competing belief system, whereas it's not. It's actually a way of looking at and describing the natural processes in the world and trying to understand them through observable natural processes, whereas, you know, religion's not about that. It's about, you know, what happens when we die and about where we came from and first principles of origin and stuff like that, and, you know, other weird sort of stuff like poking people's eyes out.
You know, that's exactly the point that I get to in all of these conversations, is trying to explain that the scientific method is, it's basically a four-step process, right, of having a hypothesis, making some predictions, doing some experiments, and doing some observations and measurements from those. And it should be repeatable by any other scientist as part of a controlled experiment.
And it should also be what they call falsifiable. So it should actually be able to, if it's incorrect, falsify those results. And that's kind of not... It's actually a difficult term to get your head around because you think falsifiable means committing fraud, but actually means having a mechanism where if it's wrong, you can demonstrate over time that it's wrong or a better explanation comes along. So I mean, those are the core tenets of the scientific method, and they've served us pretty bloody well at least since the Enlightenment. There's no better system really that's come along. I think you do get a lot of people, and some of my scientific friends, who do, and this is where it starts getting hazy, who do view it as a creed because they don't believe in any God. And so I can think that's where you get some of the religious people say, oh look, it's just another belief system, because you people who believe in the scientific method are atheists, and so that's what you use as your, I don't know, your bellwether for morality or whatever it is.
Yeah, I get that argument as well quite often. People suggest that science is my religion, and I find it really hard to explain that I do see that the scientific method is the hard-won results of thousands of years of human development and struggle to come up with a rational approach to understanding the world around us. And to take that approach and throw it out the window is an incredibly depressing thing to see people do. And these are people that are quite often very intelligent, very articulate people, but just seem to have no respect for scientific method. And I'm thinking, damn, it's the 21st century, man. Where the hell have people been for the last couple of hundred years?
Yeah, I struggle to understand it. I think because it is viewed by some people as an either or type situation. So you can either believe in science or you hold your beliefs of faith, but you can't actually hold the two because eventually one will eventually science will say there is no God or God is dead or whatever. And science doesn't go around asking those questions. You just cannot prove or disprove the existence of God. It's simply not possible. Science doesn't ask those questions. That's why I don't really understand why science gets such a bad run. I guess that the conundrum is that if there is no God, then where do things like morals and ethics arise from? Because, and this was put to me by a preacher, if we were all, evolution was everything, then surely Darwinism should govern our behaviour, and we'd be killing each other to get to the top and all that sort of thing. And it is difficult to know, where, I don't know how you come up with a rational explanation for the evolution of ethics, but I think that it probably has something to do with the fact that we realise that it's much better to cooperate with each other and form society than just to walk around killing each other.
Yeah, it's about social mechanics, right? if our existence is based around the perpetuation of our genome, we found that by cooperating together in civilizations, we actually survive longer and life is less difficult as well. Certainly, you look at the last 1,000-2,000 years of human recorded history, we live longer, we live healthier lives, we're better off now than we ever were before because of civilization, because of the scientific method.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the preachers I spoke to said, science is actually making everything better for us, but I look around and I see bombs going off in tunnels and aeroplanes being flown into buildings. So science is not making things better. And I think, well, I sort of scratch my head at that one. I thought, if you lived 100 years ago, you'd already be dead.
It's not just that. Don't get me started about the travesties committed in the name of religion in the last couple of thousand years, man. I can talk for hours about persecutions of South American Indians and American natives and Australian Aborigines and the Crusades and the destruction of the Cathars and the Protestants killing the Catholics and the Catholics killing the Protestants and everyone killing the Jews. Religion basically was the reason for war for thousands of years.
Yeah, and as we've seen, generally speaking, religious beliefs have evolved over time. So, you know, we tend not to kill each other for religious reasons as often in as many places. I mean, you certainly can't make blanket statements about that, but you know, generally speaking, religions have evolved and they've adapted, and they've, you know, at least in the West, have come off pretty well. And I think that, I honestly believe that religion has to keep on evolving and adapting, because there's a lot of good things that you can say about religion. I'm not sure about the, you know, the prosperity gospels that get taught at some of these, Pentecostal churches, you know, along the lines of, you know, God wants you to be rich and so on and so forth. I just don't necessarily think that's what religion's all about. But there's certainly a lot of good things about it. You know, the community aspects, the caring for your neighbour aspects, the social aspects, the, you know, love your neighbour as yourself, which I think was firstly the one command that you held above all others. You know, all those are good and positive things, and I just don't think that they're incompatible with science.
You know, that's why when... Yeah.
So that's why when you start coming up with these sort of bogus pseudo-scientific arguments like intelligent design about origins, I think, well, you kind of, you know, that's not even what the game is all about, you know? I mean, why is the question of origins even a problem for people with religious beliefs? I just don't understand it. But, you know, hopefully that, you know, hopefully by maintaining discourse and dialogue, people can come to some sort of, you know, mutual understanding, and we can move on.
Yeah, the other thing that I hear a lot, and I always wonder where this comes from. I hear that there's no evidence to support the theory of the Big Bang. The other thing that I hear from my Christian fundamentalist friends is that there's no evidence to support the theory of evolution. Now, I say, guys, we've been studying evolution in animals for the last, you know, 100 years. We have plenty of experimental evidence to support it. We do it. We deliberately mess with fruit fly genes today so they evolve into, they grow, you know, extra legs and different sets of wings or no wings. We know how this stuff works. Now, yeah. I think what they mean is the theory that, you know, Homo sapiens evolved from, you know, some sort of, you know, primate. But this whole thing that they're spouting, that there's no evidence to support these theories when there's plenty of evidence to support them, doesn't necessarily mean that they're inscrutable or that they're fact, but we have a theory and we have a bunch of evidence that supports the theory. Who is it that's running around telling these people that there's no evidence to support these theories?
Well, I think that what happens is, you know, you have evidence that supports the theory of evolution, but people who say there is no theory, you know, there is no evidence to support it, then run around and find the holes, you know, and there are holes. And then scientists, and this is one of the good things that's actually come out of this intelligent design debate, have actually sort of dusted off things and gone, well, yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. Maybe we'll go and find some evidence for this, and have gone off and done it. So I think that's why when people say there's no evidence for it, they actually are confusing with, yes, there are things that are not yet explained. But as we said before, you know, science gives you the tools to go and either explain it or find a better theory. And that's what many of these people say. They say, oh, you know, there are holes, and intelligent design is the better theory, and the basis of our theory is that God did it all. The Big Bang one is also interesting because there is a lot of evidence in terms of, you know, the fact that the universe is expanding. There's cosmic background radiation, which tends to demonstrate that there was actually this pretty major event. And people say, well, what was there before the Big Bang? And go, we don't know. And we don't know. It's pretty difficult to find out. But that doesn't mean that you know, there was God there before. Maybe God, as some of the theologians say, like I interviewed Philip Jensen, who's the Anglican Archbishop for Sydney, and he's perfectly comfortable with, you know, God using evolution and the Big Bang as the way of, you know, bringing the universe into existence. So that's perfectly fine. And the Catholics came out earlier this week and said, look, there's absolutely no problem with this sort of stuff. I'm just trying to find the relevant bits.
I've had a discussion with Father Bob McGuire as well over the last couple of months. He's exactly the same. He's like, who cares? Let's go help some people.
Yeah, well, this is a quote from Cardinal Paul Poparad, who's the head of the Pontifical Council for Culture, and he says, the fundamental thing is scientific meaning to words that have no scientific claim. He said that the real message in Genesis is that the universe didn't make itself and had a creator. I mean, that's a pretty good perspective, and I actually think that Father Bob's perspective is even better. It's like, who cares, you know, let's go out and actually do something that has value in the world today rather than, sit around and try and get richer, which seems to be the focus of a lot of religious beliefs these days.
Father Bob would say, it's all the mahogany room boys. The boys who sit around in their mahogany rooms, it doesn't matter. Forget about it.
Yeah.
Go help some people.
Yeah, and as I said, I think that people want reassurance, and churches are pretty damn good social networking places as well, which is, business networking places, which is why, this gospel of prosperity that's being taught in these really fast-growing Pentecostal churches catches on. People go there, they can make good business contacts, they're encouraged to think that it's good to be rich, they're encouraged...
Hey, I'm not arguing with that, it is good to be rich.
Pardon?
I'm not arguing with that, it's good to be rich. Not that I would
I'm not saying it's bad to be rich, but I'm questioning whether actually that's the point of religion, is it's good to be rich, especially when...
Come on, man, it's always been the point of religion, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I've often thought that Christianity should pretty much be, you should get rid of all the Bible and just distill it to the stuff that we had a pretty good reason for believing that Jesus said. And he comes out and says, basically, love your neighbour as yourself, and that's pretty much it. And rich men can't get into heaven. It's harder for them to fit into heaven than it is for a camel through the eye of a needle, which is an interesting aside. People always think when they read that it's the eye of a needle, the needle that you sew things with. But in fact, in the Middle East, the eye of the needle was actually a narrow passageway into buildings that stopped camels getting in. But these are
really?
The things you learn. These are the things you learn from reading Neal Stephenson's Baroque trilogy.
I never got past Snow Crash. I love Snow Crash. I haven't got.
You really should read the Baroque trilogy. I've been trying to get my wife to read it. She's like, I'm not reading a 3,000-page novel. But so I'm on my third tour through it at the moment, which probably says I should get out and read other things a bit more often. But anyway,
get Ray Kurzweil's book, man. Read that.
I will get it once Amazon gets around to delivering it to me. So I'm pretty excited about that whole idea of melding, humans and machines. I'm interested to see what sort of arguments he has, about how we're going to address social inequality in terms of these things, because I think that you could end up with a situation with, haves, those of us who are rich enough and socially connected enough to cybernetically augment ourselves and the have-nots who, end up becoming these sort of Morlock-like creatures. But, sure that he addresses that in the book.
Yeah, he does. And I mean, that's been addressed in transhumanist circles for, the last 20 years. And even going back to Eric Drexler's book, Engines of Creation in 86 on nanotech, one of the basic theories behind that is that if everyone has a nanofabricator in their house, basically the entire structure of our economy is going to kind of break down. If you have a nanofabricator and blueprints available for it, you'll be able to build out of, basic elements, nitrogen, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, etc. Pretty much everything that you want, from food to clothing to shelter to... So you'll need to go and buy stuff, and therefore you'll need to have money, is going to evaporate. So there's this idea that a lot of this stuff will just be made available by benevolent people. Open source. Think of it as the open sourcing of nanofabricators.
Yeah,
all it would take is for one Bill Gates to build one nanofabricator and give it to me, and then I build one and give it to you, and then you build 100 and give it to all the people in the bulletin offices. And your friends, because I don't have any friends, so I don't give a damn. You know what I mean? Nanofabricator should be able to make another nanofabricator.
Yeah, in theory, I guess it also means that whether that addresses things like belief fundamentalism is an interesting question too. Because if I get a nanofabricator and I think that my reward's in heaven, then I can always nanofabricate an infinite number of bombs to kill you with. So I don't know whether it actually addresses the social aspects of these things. It certainly addresses the material and the lack of plenty aspects of it. I mean, we know that there's almost an infinite amount of energy out there we could harness if we knew how to harness it. But I just don't think it's ever going to get around these sort of rather prickly questions of you know, belief and faith and, you know, I'm chosen and you're not, and I'm going to kill you for that reason. I just don't know whether we can get around it. You know, I like the sort of Star Trek utopian view as well, where we, you know, go boldly and seek out new life and all that sort of stuff. But,
well, you know, Ray said to me in the happens. Ray chastised me when I used the word utopian in the interview.
Ah, yes. Yes, and what was his reasons for that?
Well, he said it's not
because
utopian.
We're all going to fuck it up.
Well, he said, you know, there's a lot of dangers. You know, people have the ability, as you say, to make bombs or to make grey goo nanovirus type scenarios. This is kind of Bill Joy's scary scenario. But he said, you know, we will have the ability to deal, I like the way he said, we'll have the ability to deal with, you know, lots of these minor problems like poverty, death, disease. We'll eradicate those. Oh, no.
Yeah, I think we probably could eradicate them. How do we eradicate boredom? Because if all my wants and needs are met, I'm going to be pretty damn bored. I guess, like, I was talking to an astronomer recently who was hosting a rather interesting National Geographic lunch, and I said to him, is there reason to think there could be other forms of life out there that aren't based on carbon? And he said to me, well, there could be silicon life. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, if you're a machine, you're essentially immortal as long as you've got the ability to replace your parts and some form of energy. And I said, do you think we'd ever meet these, you know, silicon-based super machines? And he said, well, it's actually a really, really boring part of the galaxy to hang around in. I said, well, where would you go? And he said, there's really fascinating things happening at the galactic center. He said, if I could live forever and I was some sort of, you know, machine-human hybrid, and that's where I'd be going. I'd be taking 100,000, 200,000 years. That scientific nirvana of kicking ourselves free of the Earth and powering out into space.
Well, in Kurzweil's latest book, he talks about the six epochs of evolution, and he calls that Epoch 6, which is where, after we've basically merged with non-biological intelligence that we create, that non-biological intelligence will then spread out across the universe and re-engineer all of the matter of the universe to make it intelligent and aware. It's a pretty amazing vision.
Yeah, that reminds me of some of the books written by Greg Egan, who's a West Australian science fiction author, and he gets into that really sort of hard, you know, mathematical science fiction. And I actually find it a bit difficult to read, but that's some of the stuff that he talks about, especially at, I'm just trying to see on my bookshelf now. Yeah, he's got a couple of books to cover that sort of stuff. And he's an interesting author to seek out and read if you can deal with the mathematics. Unfortunately, he won't talk to me anymore. But, hey, you know, you get that as a journalist. So,
what did you do to him?
I asked him to do a book review, and he did it, and it was fine, but it was just a little bit long, a little bit dense. And then he disappeared, and we were on deadline, and so we edited it, and he was really upset about the edit. So, unfortunately... Yeah, Mr. Egan won't talk to me anymore. But
come on, Greg,
that's
chill
okay.
Out,
maybe
man.
There might be some rapprochement. But anyway, that's
you
yeah,
call me Cameron O'Reilly. Oh, I still talk to you.
I did call you Cameron O'Reilly. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've learned over the last 12 months is you know, if you make a mistake, you've got to. And it's actually, it's actually one of the things I got from reading Clue Train was, you know, everyone makes mistakes, and if you make a mistake, you've at least got to turn around and embrace it and acknowledge the fact you made a mistake, because people at least respect you rather than trying to, you know, sweep under the carpet and hide it and pretend it never happened.
That's so, very well said. Hey, just getting back to Kurzweil's thing before, I think it was in his book I was reading recently, you know, where we were talking about before, all of the major scientific discoveries over the last couple of hundred years have dethroned man from this role of importance that we believed we had. You know, we believe that all the planets of the stars were rotated around the Earth, and then we realized that didn't really work that way. And we thought, you know, at least, well, our sun is in the center of the universe or the center of the galaxy, and then we found out, well, actually, that's not true either. And we've been dethroned at every stage. And what I think it was in Kurzweil's book, he's saying, well, actually, we will become the most important thing in the universe through our role of creating this non-biological intelligence, if we pull this off, which then goes out and, you know, organizes the rest of the universe. Man will justify that belief that he's had for a long time that he was so important. That's our destiny.
Yeah, well, that is our destiny. I think it's pretty. It'd be interesting to see how, you know, religious belief can evolve to cope with that sort of development. I mean, I think even if you disregard some of the more what, you know, you might think are kind of out there things, then I still think you cannot argue the fact that we're going to have machines that have some form of awareness or sentience in the next 50 years or so. And, you know, how does a self-aware machine, you know, fit into our you know, metaphysical and religious worlds, you know? You know, maybe we'll have to evolve religion to cope with those sort of things. But one of the things that a self-aware machine would have to come to terms with is the fact that it does, in fact, have an intelligent designer, and that's us.
Yeah, and you know, there are different theories on whether or not they will respect that relationship or not. Kurzweil is on the side that they will respect it and that they will see us as their creators and that we'll have a respectful relationship. I'm not so sure about that. I think when the differential between their intelligence and ours is the same as ours and a rabbit, they will probably look at us as being puny, violent, pretty messed up species and basically have us all put down before we can do any damage.
Yeah, well, that's assuming that alien intelligence like that actually thinks like we do. And that's one of the difficulties we have even with, you know, subhuman intelligences like, you know, dolphins, for example, which are, you know, reasonably smart, or dogs. You know, we just don't understand how they think. So if you've got a superhuman intelligence like an alien intelligence like a machine, it's one of those mind of God things again, and this comes back to intelligent design. It's, you know, it's the height of arrogance to assume that if we are created by God, then man can know the mind of God. And I think it's also, you know, quite arrogant to assume that, you know, we can understand the mind of our creations. If we manage to create these super intelligent machines that then go out there and can actually think faster and live for longer spans than we do, I think that the way they think can be totally different to what we expect.
Yeah.
If you live for 100,000, 200,000, a million years, it's really going to change your perspective then, the solid knowledge that all of us have that we've got pretty much 80 years, and then the hope that some of us have that we're going to go on to this, you know, nirvana afterwards. I mean, the solid knowledge that you are going to live for a million years is really going to change the way that you think. And I think, you know, you are going to become this scary alien intelligence and maybe not even bother with humans.
You think about how it would change your psyche today if you thought, even if you thought you were going to live for 1,000 years, that you were basically invulnerable, that you had no need for the basics of economics because, you know, you were just using the basic elements around you to keep yourself going. It would completely change your psyche, even a human psyche would completely change, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, think about the way it would even change the relationship you have to the things you enjoy, like, you know, good food at a good restaurant, or, you know, the smell of jasmine in spring, or, having sex with somebody, or, you know, I'm a surfer, you know, the best wave you ever rode. I mean, those sort of pleasures would become, you know, become so transient as to not even bother with. So, again, it's this alien thinking. What gives pleasure to a being that lives for a million years? Maybe it's the pleasure of creation, I don't know. And then you come back to this whole idea of, you know, if there's a God, maybe the bringing into creation of things is the way that you get your kicks, who knows, and then watching how it plays out. I mean, it'd be pretty interesting to do.
Yeah, do you ever read any of Damien Broderick's writing?
No, I did hear you mention him the other day. I think it was in the Kurzweil interview, and I did make a note to go and grab some of his stuff.
Yeah, it might be a little bit out of date now, but his book, The Spike, came out in about 97. I think he did an update a few years later. It was a great book, sort of talking about all this sort of stuff. But I remember in one of the chats that he and I had a few years ago, I was talking about, you know, non-biological intelligence going out across the universe and trying to prevent the universe from collapsing so 15 billion years of evolution doesn't go up in smoke. Plus, you know, the amount of time that's going to happen between now and the collapse of the universe. And he said, yeah, but why would they care? He said, you know, this whole thing about not wanting to die and not wanting evolution to be a waste, you know, could be a very human emotion. Maybe these machines just won't care about that kind of stuff because, you know, it's maybe not logical to care about that. maybe when we remove the limbic system from our higher thought processes, none of that sort of stuff will matter.
Yeah, well, this is the sort of stuff that that Greg Egan addresses, I think, in his book Diaspora and Shield's Ladder. And Shield's Ladder is an edifice, but yeah, the alien intelligences, which are kind of engineered, you know, superhuman type things in there, you know, the coldness and the way that they think is quite scary and quite alien. To put yourself into that position is difficult to get your hand. But yeah, I just don't think that these creatures will think the way we do. But it's all such a long, long way away, and I am kind of sorry I won't live to see it. You know, maybe my daughter will, or maybe her children will. But
not according to Kurzweil, mate.
Yeah. Well,
Aubrey de Grey, for that matter.
Yes. I did listen to Aubrey. That's one of the few I've got archived.
Both of those guys reckon this will happen, you know, within the next 25 years.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that one goes. I mean, I can see Kurzweil's exponential arguments there, because people always think that things, the logical way to think of it is in linear terms, whereas it's not the way that it works. And so, yeah, perhaps he's right. I mean, 25 years, well, I'm going to be 57, you know. I don't know whether the powers would be want to waste their technology on an old bastard if he's 57.
But you won't be 57, because all of the genetics revolution that's going to kick in at the end of this decade will start to reverse engineer your DNA. So you'll actually start to get younger post about 2010. So by the time 25 years is up, you'll actually look 15 again, and you'll be breaking out of pimples and wearing Van Halen T-shirts. Or is that just me?
That could be, you know, I think that I was wandering around in Cure T-shirts, looking at, you know, wearing black and looking at the ground too much. But
hey, now, I just wanted to ask you, you didn't buy a Curta calculator after all that?
I didn't. I'm kind of obsessed with Curtas, and I know a fellow who's got one, and I'm so envious. And then there was the whole pattern recognition William Gibson thing, which I think really kicked into overdrive.
That's where I got my interest in them from, yeah. I reckon it was probably... If he was half smart, he would have, you know, bought about 1,000 of those before the book came out and sold them all on eBay at a massive profit afterwards.
He probably did. I mean, it's actually one of the things about, you know, writing, and I would certainly put myself nowhere near Gibson scale, but even, you know, some of the small things about, I wrote something about collecting vintage Seiko watches for a magazine the other week, which is one of the things I do, and I thought, I just wrote that. That means there's going to be all these people out there going, that's a bloody good idea. And so I thought, I have to try and corner the market in vintage Seiko watches before everyone gets into it. But anyway, that's vintage Seiko watches. That's definitely not Curtis. And I think that one ended up going for about $1,200, which is probably about $1,100 more than my wife would let me spend. I think it's going to sit on the mantelpiece.
Well, mate, I tell you, if TPN ever makes it into the big time, we'll pay you back for the press, the support you gave us by buying you a Curta. I'm on record as saying that. You can call me on that at some stage in the future if we don't end up sleeping on park benches drinking metho, which is what I kind of suspect will happen.
It would make a great piece of swag. You can actually start with the tooling in China and get them reproduced quite cheaply, and then give them people a swag, and they would just worship the ground that you walked on. I mean, your unit cost probably going to be $20. You're laughing.
I'm going to remember that. That's an absolutely perfect idea. The Curta swag. Josh Glidden, thanks very much for coming on, mate. I've been looking forward to having this chat for a while. It's been good fun. We would have done it over Skype, but you know, you couldn't find your way clear to getting a frickin' headset.
I know, it's pretty lame for somebody who writes about science and technology to not have, you know, pulled their finger and actually walked out and bought a headset to plug into their PowerBook. But anyway, I'll get there.
Good on you, mate. Have a good night.
Thanks, Cameron.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The following podcast of Matt Frick and the Fat Boy contains coarse language, sexual references, and adult themes that may offend some listeners. This includes material not suitable for persons under 18 years of age.
Matt Frick and the Fat Boy.
Here's anyway. Look, I've got a couple, and we should hear what the top 10 best things are about doing a podcast that no one listens to, and we mean no one.
Number 10.
You can rest easy in the knowledge that no one on the street is going to harass you for an autograph, especially not young girls with massive norgs and a thirst for man glue. You wouldn't want that.
Number 9.
Your 2-minute, 20-second weekly production meeting feels justified.
Number 8.
You can record each podcast tank to the eyeballs and high as a kite. Who cares about professionalism when there's no audience?
Number 7.
No money means no tiresome paperwork. It's easier to have nothing than millions and millions of dollars. Much easier.
Number 6.
You don't have to worry about guest appearances, lucrative corporate speaking gigs, or waking up at the crack of dawn to do your top rating breakfast show. It's up at 1 in the afternoon and nothing more taxing than a casual bus ride down to the Dole office for you.
Number 5.
You don't have to reply to hundreds of emails. The only person who ever writes to you is an unhinged English teenager who doesn't know when to fuck off. You know who you are.
Number 4.
You have the pleasure of explaining the definition of the word podcast to literally everyone.
Number 3.
You get to work to your own deadlines, which is whenever the fuck you want, as long as it doesn't conflict with your two great loves, sleeping and touching yourself.
Number 2.
You get the pleasure of working with a fat fuckwit who contributes nothing to each show, week after week after week. Nothing.
Nothing.
And the best thing about doing a podcast that no one listens to...
Number 1.
You get to say the word cunt whenever you want. Who's going to stop you? Cameron and Mick, the podcast network owners? Ha! They're the biggest cunts of all! Sheep cunts.
This is Matt Freak and the Fat Boy. Enjoy all our crap on thepodcastnetwork.com.
Hey. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, from the beginning. That's right. I'm back at the end. I waited around for the entire podcast just to tell you that it was brought to you by Motorola. Yeah, dude. I gotta get some nachos. I am so hungry. Are there any near your house?
The Podcast Network. Real power can't be given.
It must be taken.